Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on rioting in Afghanistan following the burning of Korans at a US base and look into the selective nature of the outrage since the same rioters routinely sack Shiite mosques and burn Korans along with people. Chris Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan, joins us to analyze why the people whose nation we are trying to build appear to hate us and want us out of their country. Then Senator Russ Feingold joins us. He is the author of the new book, While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post-9/11 era. The only senator to vote against the Patriot Act, we will discuss how much we have waged the war on terror on ourselves and our own values, and how we are alienating the Islamic world by demonizing Muslims who want the freedoms we have and want to be free of the dictatorships that we have supported. Then finally, with tonight's Academy Awards broadcast expected to reach a record global audience, cultural critic and media expert and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside, Toby Miller, joins us. We will discuss the global influence of Hollywood movies in an era when piracy is diminishing box office returns and big-budget, special effects-laden comic book blockbusters have driven highbrow, lower-budget movies towards extinction. Let's begin with Christine Fair, who is a former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And clearly, the situation in Afghanistan has reached, I should think, for our men and women in uniform, a pretty untenable situation. If you have a U.S. colonel and a U.S. major being murdered inside the secure Ministry of Interior, and I imagine a general sense amongst the soldiers over there serving that the people that they're trying to rescue and make a viable economy and a life for, and for whom a lot of American lives have been sacrificed, seem to be fairly ungrateful at the very least, and they seem to be demonstrating in large numbers, asking the U.S. to leave. So, how do you think the service people feel about serving a country where it appears a lot of the people want them to get out?
Well, it's been my experience over the several years I've been going to Afghanistan that is pretty much the sentiment. I remember last summer when I was at the COIN Academy, the Counterinsurgency Academy run by the Americans there at Kabul, I was in the shower room and I was overhearing a female sergeant in very colorful terms explaining her exasperation with the new bunch of folks that she was tasked with training. And I couldn't help but overhear the conversation. She says, forget, and I'm going to leave the expletives out because I don't think you're supposed to have expletives on this show. But she said, forget the dancing monkey and the PowerPoint slide. I can reduce this for you in a matter of sentences. These people hate you. They want to kill you. But that really won't affect you because you will never leave this base. And there's a certain amount of brilliance in that relatively parsimonious statement because it's absolutely true. The few Americans that do get out find themselves in extreme harm's way. Folks, far from being grateful, are actually exceedingly resentful. They tend to blame the counterinsurgency on the Americans, which has become sort of a stand-in for all of the Westerners operating there under the NATO umbrella. And what they have seen has largely been a degradation in the kinds of personal security rather than an improvement in the same. And therefore, even though they don't like the Taliban, I've had a number of people tell me that at least when the Taliban were in power, they didn't have to worry about their houses being robbed or their women being raped. So, my own personal view, and it's been this way for a very long time, as you know, is that the mission that we have slowly accepted was never tenable to begin with, given our interest, well, given the cost either in terms of finances or in terms of blood that we're willing to pay. And it really is time to get out.
So In terms of nation building, my understanding is there are two major components, and that is the USAID component, and of course the notion that we are building a viable Afghan army and a viable Afghan police force in order to have some stability when we leave. Beginning with the first, Chris Fair, the aid. There's just been some recent reports that are quite alarming, the extent to which so much of the aid is either being lost in what's euphemistically called bureaucratic mismanagement, or in fact being stolen outright. And their estimates up to 40% of it being stolen outright. And apparently the Afghan Central Bank has tried to do something about capital flight. Here's a country where we're pouring money in, but every day millions and millions of US dollars in cash exit Kabul's airport, and an estimated $4.6 billion in cash, more than the country's government budget, left Afghanistan in 2011, according to the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, you already summed it up. Whenever I fly from Kabul to Dubai, I always want to climb into the baggage hold to reclaim some of my tax dollars, because literally, there are literal pallets of $100 bills being shipped in the cargo holds of those planes. And here's the outrageous part. It's being done so openly that usually those monies are declared, which is how we know about these preposterous sums. At one point, the Department of Treasury wanted to monitor the amounts of funds leaving. That's really not, I mean, quantifying it is kind of interesting, but the real problem is why is it actually leaving? But look, the problems with USAID, and I want to be very clear, it's not just USAID. All of the national aid programs suffer from very similar problems. I mean, there are some exceptions, like the Canadian aid problem. The Canadian aid program doesn't seem to be as problematic as the UK DFID or the US USAID program. But even the Germans, GTZ, everyone is kind of laboring under similar problems. The first kind of goes like this. The days of the American USAID poorly paid employee/volunteer going out and building an irrigation system, those days are gone. Those days in the 50s, you talk to Afghans, oh yeah, you know, who happened to live that long. I remember Americans out there digging a ditch. Those days are gone. What USAID has really become is like a booking agency. So they'll outsource large projects to sort of industrial contractors who then hire subcontractors who then subsequently hire subcontractors. So at every single layer of contracting, I know because I've been a USAID contractor and other kinds of contractors, the organization doing the paperwork basically gets an overhead cut just to basically have the privilege of having some part of this grant. So when Richard Holbrooke was alive and when he first took over the portfolio, he estimated that, speaking of USAID alone, every 90 cents for every dollar allocated, about approximately 90 cents actually came back to the U.S. in this institutional overhead. The other problem is, for you to get anything done in Afghanistan, you really have to pay the right person. And if you don't pay the right person, you're going to find IEDs on your road. You're going to find your employees being targeted. And so you really have to spread the money around to make sure that, I love it when they are our guy, we call them strong men, but you know, when they're a nuisance, we call them warlords. You have to make sure that the money goes all the way around. And then in addition, just getting the logistics anywhere in Afghanistan frankly requires paying the different militant groups associated with the Taliban a handsome fee. So we could spend your entire show talking about the delinquent malfeasance and just absolute lack of progress coming out of U.S. programming, because, you know, at some point you have to also remember, from USAID's point of view, what they're being judged upon is execution of the funds. They're not being judged upon what are the outcomes. They're actually just being judged on are the funds executed? Is there going to be an output? If we want to build a bridge, is there a bridge? Whether or not that bridge actually endures the first flood or the first rain is immaterial. It's all about execution. Going to the second part of your question, which is about training the ANSF, I mean, that's almost a serious joke is the first part. at steady state, it's really hard to imagine an Afghan National Army more than 100,000 for any number of reasons. A, people don't want to serve. They like being near their homes. Being a part of a national organization requires them to not be near their homes. Training the Afghan National Police is even a bigger problem. The vast majority of the police, like the ANA, they're not even literate. I could, again, could go on at length about this. But what the U.S. has essentially done with our NATO allies, and quite frankly with the connivance of the Afghan Ministry of Defense for obvious reasons, we have built an enormous Afghan National Security Force infrastructure comprised of the Army, comprised of the different police forces, as well as the other services. The Afghan government, of course, has absolutely no ability to pay for any aspect of its functioning, not even the recurring cost of salaries. So the real question is, given that the Afghan state can't pay for any of this, and given that we've built a supersized government, and given that as troops draw down, parliaments, including our Congress, are going to be less enthusiastic about paying the bills, what happens to this now 340-some-odd thousand Afghan National Security Force that we've paid for? It's going to become bedlam, mayhem, all hell is going to break loose. And most people that you talk to who travel frequently to Afghanistan will tell you people are bracing for civil war. And I have to say, I suspect that's, in my view, that's where this is heading.
But in terms of training Afghan soldiers, you've just pointed out how tenuous the whole thing is, because as soon as we pull the financial plug, this kind of Potemkin village is going to collapse. But meanwhile, while we are training the soldiers and police, a lot of them are killing NATO and American soldiers, not the least of which, of course, is what just happened inside the Ministry of Interior building, but also today in Kunduz province, a U.S. Special Forces base, somebody tossed a grenade, wounding seven U.S. Special Forces. So this has been going on for some time. I mean, are there any statistics on it?
I don't think so. But what there have been efforts for some time to try to get Afghan intelligence, the NDF, to try to implement better screening. They're even talking about biometric measures to keep a better eye on who's joining the ANSF, because one of the things that we've seen in recent years is that either insurgents disguised as Afghan National Security Force personnel or people who are in uniform, Afghans in uniform, who just decide they're going to take up the gun against the Americans and NATO, they've been killing these folks while in uniform. I actually just stopped counting the incidents because there had been so many. But this really began with a fairly alarming frequency, maybe 3 to 4 years ago. But it's given that that there is such an urgent demand, a perceived urgent demand, to create ANSF, you know, to Afghan National Security Forces, and given that it's kind of hard to recruit these folks, I mean, basically they'll take anyone. So if you were the Taliban or militants associated or sympathetic to the Taliban, this is a no-brainer. Put your murderous goon in the process for applying to join the Afghan National Police or the Afghan National Army. It's the easiest thing in the world. So there's a lot of concern, and obviously if you're the Afghan Taliban and their allied associates, you see the end is near. The Americans want out. So our staying power is declining as their interest in driving us out is intensifying. So I actually expect we're going to see more of this faux fratricide. I mean, I'm saying faux fratricide because allegedly we're supposed to be in the same team. And there have equally been incidents of insurgents in uniform or people in uniform who became insurgents also killing Afghan forces that are working with the Americans. So this is a big problem, and it's not obvious what you do about it other than endure it, because if you're trying to build an ANSF force that is this big, you're not going to be able to do this big and this quickly. You're not going to be able to do the due diligence that you need to keep the wackos out.
Well, it looks like, Chris Fair, that this police officer who was working for the Intelligence Department of the Ministry of Interior, he's apparently disappeared. It looks as though he may well have been one of the people you're talking about, a Taliban mole.
That's just entirely possible. I mean, there are so many people that are expected of being Taliban mole and are Taliban moles, and it's really difficult to do the kinds of checks. Look, I mean, think about this. 11 years into this war, we don't even have a proper amount of capable linguists. So we are still dependent upon interpreters. And the interpreters that are working with the Americans and NATO, we sort of assume that they're on our team. Well, why in the world would you assume that? I've had so many conversations with these firms to which the U.S. Armed Forces outsource finding interpreters. So, you know, I myself have language training, and on LinkedIn or other venues, I'm constantly being approached. Do you have any language? Do you know anyone that's like, you know, competent in XYZ languages? And they need linguists faster than they can actually vet them. And their efforts to get American linguists, for a number of reasons, have failed, even though we're training thousands of linguists. And we're training lots of people through the Title VI, which is the FLAS program, as well as through the Critical Language program. The issue is, and I know this from my own experience, when you have a linguist who spent a lot of time outside of the country, someone like I have, it's very difficult to clear them. When I go through U.S. government processing, they consider me to be a counterterrorism or a counterintelligence threat, even though my language studies were all paid for by the government. So there's this horrific irony that we're training all these people, but by training linguists who then go and try to dedicate their studies to learning these languages outside of the U.S., we've essentially made them unclearable. And so we're having to constantly go back to the well in Afghanistan for these linguists. And it's these linguists who, in turn, are helping to vet these folks who are killing our troops. This is, I don't know what else to call this other than retardation.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan. She's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're talking about the latest deaths of an American colonel and a major inside of the Interior Ministry, apparently killed by an Afghan policeman in the Intelligence Department of the Ministry of Interior, who has since disappeared. There's been a rash of killings of U.S. soldiers training Afghan police and military, and all of this in the context of riots going on still following the burning of some Qurans at the major U.S. base there. And these Qurans that were burned apparently were ones that they took off militants who had, I don't know whether they were already a militant version of the Quran or whether they had been had some scribblings in them. But it's pretty hard to believe that somebody in the U.S. military was brain dead enough to burn them and allow that to become such an incident. But to my mind, it raises some fundamental questions about the very people who are demonstrating in the streets. It's fairly routine, from what I can tell, in Pakistan at least, for these Sunni fundamentalists to burn and sack Shiite mosques and murder people and burn them alive in their churches or mosques, not to mention burning the Qurans.
You know, it's almost to the point where it's very difficult for me to have a conversation that remains in a scholarly realm about this, because the murderous hypocrisy is so difficult to tolerate. When the Taliban go in and raise girls' schools in Pakistan, or in Afghanistan for that matter, they destroy dozens of Qurans. When they blow up Shia mosques, hundreds of Qurans. So this is not about Quran burning. Let's just say that for the moment of argumentation, that it is about Quran burning. Howsoever heinous that is, it doesn't justify killing innocent people who had nothing to do. And what I find really, one of the things that I find very frustrating is someone who spends a lot of time in the Muslim world, spends a lot of time in South Asia. I am really exhausted to the point where I don't even know how to, I can't even keep myself within a scholarly circle when I try to express my exhaustion with people justifying murder because the Quran was burnt. And there is, you know, I know in my own tweets I've been attacked by nutters of a variety, you know, all sorts of religious bents. Facebook the same. What I find really interesting, and this raises issues of globalization, citizenship, human rights, global values, I think it's really interesting that that folks, for example, in Pakistan or Afghanistan, where I spend more of my time than other places, they will decry the abuses that Muslim minorities experience in Western countries. Now, I'm going to be also very clear, in the few places where I'm actually going to defend the U.S. system, minorities in the United States have a lot more freedom to practice, to gather, to assemble, to observe their faith than minorities do in Pakistan or minorities do in Afghanistan. It is actually considered a criminal offense punishable by death if you convert to another faith from Islam in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so one of the things I find myself consistently shocked by is that folks will demand treatment in other parts of the world that they will not even tolerate to be extended to the minorities in their own country. And one of the things that I've become very frustrated with is someone who moves, you know, back and forth, and I have many Pakistani friends and many Muslim friends, I'm increasingly at a loss as to how to negotiate the fact that one of the reasons why in the United States religious minorities of all varieties tend to have so much more civil liberties than they do in, say, Muslim countries, I would imagine, although I don't spend time in preponderantly Catholic countries, or I don't even know if there are countries where Catholicism is law. That's how ignorant I am, because I'm only a South Asianist. But the reason why there is such relative freedom here is that there is freedom of speech. So the same side, the other side of the very coin that confers freedom of speech also gives religious freedom and other kinds of freedom to engage in speech acts that are deemed offensive by others, such as, for example, these idiots that go around burning Qurans. And so it's very difficult to have a discussion about what are the limits of civil liberties. And this is just one of those issues that cuts to the core. And if I were finding people in Pakistan, for example, arguing that Bibles shouldn't be burnt, that Shia mosques couldn't be burnt, with the same vociferousness as we see organized protests against, this was apparently, in fact, an unintentional Quran burning. It's how do you go forward if this is the way in which the terrain of the debate is laid out?
Well, the terrain of the debate now, Chris Fair, is even more confused because we have a presidential campaign already. You have Newt Gingrich complaining that President Obama apologized about the burning of the Quran. And frankly, there is some confusion in this country about our approach to religious fanaticism, whether it's Islamic or Christian. We have, in many ways, Rick Santorum, what he's suggesting when he just yesterday said Obama was a snob because he thought Americans should go to college.
When he has more degrees than Obama.
Right, but he also is an advocate of homeschooling. He doesn't believe in public school. He, in effect, believes in American madrasas.
Well, okay, so it's interesting that you raise this point of American madrasas, because I think madrasas or madrasas get a pretty bad rap. They tend to be too easily conflated with things that are bad when there's actually quite a number of madrasas or madrasas. But I think what the two issues have in common, parents who send their kids to madrasas for full-time schooling, for the most part, kids go to madrasas in conjunction with other kinds of schools. So in that sense, it's more akin to going to catechism classes after school, or there's a similar version that my Catholic friends went to every Friday night, or for that matter, going to Torah school, you might study for bat mitzvah or bar mitzvah. And so most students that go to a madrasa will do so for a very brief amount of time, generally learning to recite the Quran, or maybe even if they're capable and adequately ambitious, to memorize the Quran. So it's a very small number of people who actually go to a madrasa full time. And remember, the parents are typically making that decision. And so in that sense, when I look at families that decide to homeschool and families that decide to send their kids to madrasas, one has to really ask for the values of the family, that their family somehow thinks that interacting with fellow citizens and understanding the diversity of their country, a diversity in beliefs, a diversity in morals and ethics and what's good, right, and appropriate, families actually want to take their children out of that environment so that they can vertically integrate their own moral sphere with those of their children. And I can tell you, I have family members that are homeschoolers in Indiana. Dare I say it, they're not terribly well educated themselves. And so I kind of, you know, this whole idea of like, who gets to homeschool and what's the criteria of achievement is kind of mind-boggling. But I think the point that you're raising is something that I've observed over the last 10 years. Pakistanis and Americans have responded to the events of 9/11 in really frighteningly similar ways. For many Americans and for many Pakistanis, nationalism and the majority faith have become totally imbricated. So being a certain kind of Muslim has become associated with being nationalism. Pakistan's a Muslim country, and not just any kind of Muslim, but a specific kind of Muslim. And this is why we see all the sectarian violence that we see, and it's been increasing. In the United States, the response has been, we're a Christian country. And very similar, what I'm going to just call very, using terribly normal, moralistic or normative expressions, an absolute ignorant expression of faith. In Pakistan, many of the things that they believe about Islam have no grounding in their faith whatsoever. And I'll say very similar normative statements about the religious fundamentalism that is embracing the United States. Absolute ignorance. And how do you have a dialogue between two countries where basically religious extremists, and by extremists I don't necessarily mean violent, but people who choose to believe or embrace interpretations of their faith, which were a number of years ago in the extreme, but which are now mainstream. How do you have a discussion when these two important countries have really located themselves on similar trajectories? And same people in Pakistan who want a different Pakistan, they're like me and you here, you know, except the price is higher. I mean, if you object to the blasphemy law in Pakistan because it's, even if you reject it because it's not consistent with the evidentiary standards of the Quran, you may very well be killed. So the space in both of our countries for contesting the kind of country that we want, in my experience, has been shrinking. And it's a very frightening space to be in when you don't feel like you have the space to fight for what you think your founding fathers intended. And, of course, in both cases, they were founding fathers. There were no founding mothers.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan. She's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Senator Russ Feingold.